Welcome to Constitution Ave, a new podcast where we dive deep into the week's hottest news topics, from the halls of Congress to the Oval Office. I'm Sam Dorman, and these are my co-hosts, Nathan Wester.
Hi there.
And Jacob Berg.
Hello.
And special guest, Epoch Times reporter, Janice Heisel. Today, we're going to discuss the ongoing clash between the judicial and the executive branches over Trump's deportations, RFK Jr.'s comments about autism's origins, and how the case against Ryan Ruth, the man accused of attempting to assassinate Trump, is proceeding in Florida. I'm Sam, and I cover the judicial branch, which has been colliding with the executive branch in recent weeks, creating the conditions for what might be described as a constitutional crisis. Two federal judges have issued orders related to the Trump administration's deportations of individuals to El Salvador in March. In response, the Department of Justice has repeatedly accused the judges of encroaching on executive authority and wading too deep into foreign affairs. Each of the cases has already reached the Supreme Court and will likely return as attorneys hash out the boundaries between the two branches' powers. In a somewhat of a bleak warning, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit said the two branches face a, quote, incipient crisis, unquote. Fourth Circuit Judge Harvey Wilkinson, writing with two of his colleagues, said that both branches would be harmed. So what specifically is this all about? Well, in March, President Trump invoked an 18th century law known as the Alien Enemies Act. He said that under that law, he could deport members of the Venezuelan Tren de Aragua gang, which has been designated as a foreign terrorist organization. Among the many legal criticisms that invocation has faced, a federal judge in D.C., Judge James Boasberg, issued two orders blocking the administration from continuing with deportations under that act. The Supreme Court intervened earlier this month, vacating both of those orders. Boasberg, however, said that he could still inquire into whether the administration was in criminal contempt for refusing to follow an order the Supreme Court had vacated. To avoid contempt, he suggested that the government should reassert custody over individuals who had been deported to El Salvador so they could receive some kind of due process. In Maryland, federal judge Paula Zinis similarly suggested the administration could face contempt for not following her order to facilitate the return of one of the men that was deported. This is the case involving Kilmore Abrego Garcia, whom the administration said was deported due to an administrative error. It's also said that he is a member of MS-13 and will be redeported if returned to the United States. While the administration has been paying El Salvador to take prisoners, the exact contours of the agreement are unclear. The issue has been drawing differing reactions from legal experts. Nima Romani, who worked on immigration issues in Obama's DOJ, told the Epoch Times that the judges were overstepping their authority. One of the primary issues in Abrego Garcia's case is what the administration must do to, quote, facilitate, unquote, Abrego Garcia's return. Romani indicated that that requirement didn't put as high of a burden on the administration as some might suggest.
Look, well, what that means is if he shows up at the border, they have to let him in, right? Okay, well now they're saying they're going to take him into custody, but there is nothing the courts or the judiciary could do. There's nothing in Article 3 that can force the executive to engage in any foreign policy.
John Hsu, a constitutional law expert who worked for both Bush administrations, told the Epoch Times that
it's been publicly reported that the United States and El Salvador agreed that El Salvador, in exchange for $6 million U.S. dollars, will temporarily hold the detainees for 1 year, whereupon the Trump administration will determine their disposition. This means that the United States government has constructive custody of the deportees, which in turn means that upon a final court order, the Trump administration may request that El Salvador release the deportees into actual U.S. custody.
Okay, and switching gears a bit, let's go to Nathan, who has some information on how Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr. has been addressing autism.
Thanks, Sam. I'm a national politics reporter, so I cover a variety of topics, including a recent announcement from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. On April 16th, reporters questioned him about one of the most controversial topics in public health, autism. President Trump's new Secretary of Health and Human Services previously pledged to find out the causes of autism by September. But the mid-April press conference wasn't about causes. It was about frequency. Kennedy was on stage with Dr. Walter Zorodny, a clinical psychologist. Zorodny co-authored the CDC's new report on autism rates in young children. Another health official, Dr. Mehmet Oz, sat in the audience. The agency now estimates that 1 in 31 8-year-olds have autism, up from 1 in 54 in 2016 and 1 in 150 in 2002. and some of the earliest estimates were much, much lower. A 1970 study of almost 900,000 Wisconsin children found that fewer than 1 in 10,000 met the criteria for, quote, early infantile autism, unquote. The CDC's new report pointed out that estimates were higher in California, where there's lots of early screening. But Kennedy argued that big recent increases aren't just because of better screening and diagnostics.
And then there is an individual injury. These are kids that this is a preventable disease. We know it's an environmental exposure. It has to be. Genes do not cause epidemics. They can provide a vulnerability. You need an environmental toxin.
Kennedy's claim that autism is preventable and use of the term epidemic have prompted pushback from some scientists and autism advocates. A statement on the new report from the Autism Society of America claims talk of preventability is, quote, not science-based, unquote. It adds that the term epidemic, quote, perpetuates falsehoods, stigma, and stereotypes, unquote. Zorodny, the co-author of the study, did not distance himself from the word epidemic.
I would urge everyone to consider the likelihood that autism, whether you call it an epidemic, a tsunami, or a surge of autism, is a real thing that we don't understand, and it must be triggered or caused by environmental or risk factors. We need to address this question seriously because, in my opinion, for the last 20 years, we've collected data but not made real progress in understanding what causes autism or how to effectively prevent it or treat it effectively.
Those risk factors, as distinct from environmental toxins, include how old parents are when they have their kids. Parental ages have been rising too. I asked Kennedy if they could be significant to what we're seeing. Here's what he said.
We're going to look at all of that. We're going to look at obesity in the parents. We're going to look at the age of the parents. We're going to look at diabetes in the parents. We're going to look at all of these potential exposures. And because of AI and because of the digitalization of health records and the mass of health records that are now available to us, we can do this much more quickly than has ever been done in the past.
Kennedy held off on saying that a definitive explanation would come by September. Instead, he said we would have, quote, some of the answers by that time.
We're going to follow the science no matter what it says.
The secretary told reporters that new studies probing the environmental contributors to autism would be announced within 2 or 3 weeks. Many still want to know who will be conducting that research. As the founder of Children's Health Defense, Kennedy alleged links between vaccines and autism, something many scientists dispute. But he didn't mention vaccines at all during the April 16th press conference. Through the years, autism has remained one of Kennedy's top concerns. In a 2024 interview with American thought leaders, he worried about increasing autism and other chronic diseases among young children.
6% of kids had chronic diseases when my uncle's president. Today it's 60%. This is existential. It's not sustainable, and it's getting worse and worse exponentially.
The causes of autism may prove to be complex. Any answers Kennedy provides by September will no doubt be controversial for someone. And now it's on to Jacob Berg, who has been covering the latest on a would-be Trump assassin. Take it away, Jacob.
Thank you, Nathan. I'm Jacob Berg, and I cover aviation and national politics, particularly the executive branch. Today, I'm excited to talk about my ongoing treks across the state of Florida to cover the pretrial hearings for the second man accused of trying to assassinate Trump, Ryan Ruth. But make sure to stay tuned until the end so you can hear from our colleague, Janice Heisel, who can describe the tensions and fear that ripped through the crowd last year in Butler, Pennsylvania, when she was standing just feet away from Trump when he was shot in the air by Thomas Matthew Crooks. Janice covered Trump's 2024 campaign and does deep dives on leading news topics. She has been in the industry for more than 30 years. But back to Ruth, who will face a jury in September in the exact same courtroom and before the same judge that Trump grappled with during his classified documents case. Authorities accused Ruth of camping out for 12 hours at Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach, Florida on September 15, 2024. A Secret Service agent saw an SKS-style rifle poking through the tree line, fired a shot, and the suspect, believed to be Ruth, fled. He was later apprehended by police. Ruth, often appearing jovial and in good spirits the moments before each hearing, has an interesting habit of trying to make eye contact with the courtroom artists and the various reporters, like me, who are there to cover his case. His legal team has advanced some interesting arguments. In December, they suggested they may pursue an insanity defense, but with no filings on that by the judge's February deadline, it seems that argument is now off the table. Now they insist on a live firing of the gun Ruth is accused of aiming at the president, suggesting that if the gun doesn't work, and he was aware of that fact, it would imply Ruth was not intending to do what the government is accusing him of, mainly trying to assassinate Trump. The judge will allow a test of the gun, but just to determine if it works and not to test its range or its ability to actually hit a target from the alleged distance between Ruth and Trump. Legally, a defendant can still be charged with attempted murder, even if it's physically impossible to kill someone with the weapon used. It will be interesting to see how this case plays out, and I'll be taking more three-hour treks across the dairy farm pastures of Central Florida to see this unfold in person. And who knows? Maybe I'll see a panther or a black bear next time instead of hundreds of cows, but I'm not crossing my fingers. And now, this week, I learned about Nikita Kassap, a 17-year-old from Waukesha, Wisconsin, accused of killing his parents as part of a plot to overthrow the U.S. government and kill the president. He went down an extremist rabbit hole on the internet, inspired by the teachings of a satanic neo-Nazi occult group called the Order of the Nine Angles. The extremist group advocates for the use of violence and terrorism to overthrow governments and destroy modern civilization. The teen was allegedly communicating with a person in Russia who said they were also working to kill Trump and overthrow the U.S. government. Police say they found what they believed to be the teen's manifesto on his cell phone describing his scheme. Authorities say he was trying to buy a drone to modify and use as a weapon of mass destruction. He was apprehended in Kansas after police found his parents dead in their home, and his arraignment is scheduled for May 7. But wait, there's more. We also know the Iranian government, according to federal prosecutors, was plotting to kill Trump before the 2024 election. Clearly, Trump took that threat very seriously because he told reporters in February that he had left instructions for his administration to literally obliterate Iran if its government ever succeeded in killing him. But what about the potential Secret Service report on the two known attempts on his life last year? Well, I reached out to the White House on Friday to get an update since Trump had said he was inclined to release that report publicly when he receives it. An official said they would get back to me soon. Trump told Fox News he would like to hear more about how both attempts on his life unfolded. But with Ruth still yet to go on trial, it's not clear when the public will learn more from the Secret Service on that case. Now, let's talk more about these attempts on Trump's life, and towards the end, you'll get a unique opportunity to hear directly from our colleague who sadly had to watch in real time the moment a gunman opened fire on Trump's rally in Butler, Pennsylvania last year. Nathan, weren't you telling me about Ruth's attempts to buy a rocket launcher from a Ukrainian contact?
Yes, this is according to a recent DOJ filing. This would have been a month before his arrest. And in one exchange, he reportedly requested either an RPG, this would be a rocket-propelled grenade, or a Stinger, and you can remember those Stingers came from the U.S. He said, "I will see what we can do," and that Trump is not good for Ukraine. And remember, this is the same man who invited Iran to assassinate Trump in a self-published book, was interviewed by the New York Times while he was in Ukraine. This was, of course, prior to everything that happened, and even appeared at an April 2022 rally for the Azov Brigade. This is one of the more radical groups that has associated itself with the Ukrainian cause and has been associated with the Ukrainian government. So we're looking at all this alongside the details that are coming out as a result of these trials and also speculation, for example, from a former FBI agent. He said that he would be, quote, shocked, unquote, if he had not been in contact with, or rather had his devices compromised by intel agencies. Remember also that he was convicted in 2002 in North Carolina for having a weapon of mass destruction and was clearly on somebody's radar. We just, at this point, I suppose, have to hope that more information comes out, but the Ukrainian connections are certainly troubling.
That's really interesting because Kassap, based on the FBI affidavit that I was able to pull from the federal court system, was showing that Kassap himself, aside from the Russian contact I had mentioned, who he was speaking to that also wanted to overthrow the government, seemed that Kassap's intentions were to also get a weapon of mass destruction. In this case, he was going to purchase a drone from somebody that he was speaking to, I believe, on a Telegram group, and modify that in some very troubling ways to use that as a weapon for multiple attacks. And he even told his classmate who spoke to police that he, that if they saw something like 10 attacks in the news, that would have been him. But the Ukraine connection is there as well, because Kasap allegedly had planned to move to Ukraine after carrying this out. It's not exactly clear how he was going to get overseas, especially if he was successful in carrying out some of these terrorist acts. But he was talking about brushing up on his Russian and his Ukrainian as well to anticipate living over there. Now, Janice, I would really love to hear about the experience you had last year in Butler. Right out the gate, can you talk about perhaps maybe what the tension, what the emotions were like in the crowd before it happened, and then maybe immediately right after shots rang out, how people reacted, and maybe how the Secret Service handled the incident?
Sure. Jacob, thank you guys for having me. I got to tell you, I'd like to actually start before the shots rang out, things that in hindsight now really stand out at me. I had covered up to that point 34 prior Trump events. And this one I felt a little uneasy about as I walked into the Butler Farm Show grounds. I remember looking around and having like kind of just a fleeting thought that, you know, there are an awful lot of buildings here. I wonder how they can secure all of these. And then I dismissed it because you're thinking, you know, these people know what they're doing. They've done a ton of these events. You know, I've got a job to do. And, you know, it was a fleeting thought. But then in hindsight, it really started to speak louder to me. Like my instincts were saying that something wasn't right here. And on top of that, the security procedures were a little odd that day, in my experience. For example, normally they won't let you into the area that all of us reporters refer to as the press pen, where they keep us penned up. And that particular area, I was actually able to access it without showing a press badge, which had never happened at any of the prior rallies. So with that as the prelude for everything that happened later, Trump, this was one of the ones where Trump was notoriously late. And it was very, very hot that day. People were waiting for I think he was like 2 hours late, and people were just baking. I felt so bad. There were a lot of real old elderly people sitting on the ground, just, you know, being fanned off. And, then all of a sudden when Trump shows up, of course, the crowd was very energized. This was the moment they'd been waiting for. And I followed my normal procedure was I go toward the front. They keep the print reporters kind of back behind the TV cameras. And I had gone up onto the press riser, shot some videos of the crowd. There were expressions of joy on people's faces with their cell phones in the air, capturing images of Trump. And then I went back to my laptop behind the press riser and started taking notes. And I always record Trump's speeches when I was covering them. And the next thing you know, I mean, literally, it was like, I think 3 minutes after I sat down is when the shots were fired. And at first, people in the crowd were just going, it's a mass shooting. They thought it was somebody in the crowd. And so there was the main thing I can tell you that I experienced is it went from joy and enthusiasm to instant horror and confusion. And just being in the middle of all of that, you could really feel that from the crowd. And then here I am as a reporter fighting with this instinct, like, I don't know what's going on. It's my job to figure that out. But also as a human being going, I don't know how much danger I might be in. Now, thankfully, later on, I found out I wasn't exactly in the line of fire or anything. But it was a very confusing, harrowing experience, even for people who were way in the back. One young man I spoke to, I will never forget this quote. He said that it was like 1,000 faces of terror turned and faced him in one instant.
That's incredible. That's quite the reaction for sure. And as this was unfolding, how quickly, because I know immediately the Secret Service reacted. We all saw the videos, and they jumped on the stage and luckily got Trump down away from the line of fire because it was multiple shots, right? And but after that, how quickly were first responders on the scene, just out of curiosity?
It seemed like pretty quick. In fact, I know that they had first responders on the scene already because, you know, they were attending to people who were suffering from the heat, trying to treat people who were suffering from heat. It's standard procedure to have a medic crew or a few of them on site there. But actually, the people in my section of the area, we really didn't even know exactly what was going on for the longest time. Some of us were taking cover. A lot of people were taking cover, just kind of ducking down, trying to figure out what was going on. I didn't really pay that much attention to how quickly they arrived because I knew they were already on scene. And so that part of it was just not something I really observed directly.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing that has me really curious is you did countless Trump events after this, so many rallies, speeches. What was it like at the other events and rallies? Like, were the security procedures pretty fairly robust at that point? Like, or was there a change that you noticed?
There was a very noticeable change. In fact, my manager at the Epoch Times was kind enough to offer to, you know, let me get off of the duty of covering the very next rally, which was actually after the Republican National Convention. And so it was like 12 days I was away from home, I believe, from my home here in Ohio. But I wanted to do it because I felt like, just like a person who falls off a horse, you feel like if you don't get back on the horse, you won't want to you'll be too afraid to ever ride the horse again. And I just felt like I needed to do that. And so I was a little nervous when I went to the next rally, which was up in Michigan. And when I got there, I had never seen or experienced before such an outpouring of gratitude for the law enforcement. There was a lot of law enforcement, way more than usual. There were police officers on bikes, horseback throughout the entire crowd as you were leading into the venue, and people were just saying thank you and applauding as the police went past. It was quite the sight.
That's great to hear. Well, hopefully moving forward when we have, especially on the campaign trail, but also outside, I'm hoping we've got better security for obviously for Trump and all for candidates that are facing Secret Service protection with rising political extremism now. And especially with the Ryan Ruth case, we're going to have to see how this plays out. Obviously, the trial is not set until September. I'm hoping I will be stationed over there for the week that it's proceeding. And we'll have to see how his defense comes forward with their arguments. And it's not clear what's going to happen with this live fire of this gun. And for now, that seems to be all the time we have left. Thank you for listening to Constitution Ave with me, Jacob Berg, Nathan Wester, and Sam Dorman. Join us again next week for the most intriguing topics in news and politics. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple, and elsewhere. And please be sure to give us a 5-star review if you enjoy the show. Catch us next time.